I also gather this is being recorded. I'm trying to record it as well. A lot of my lectures are on my website if you're interested in, and if my battery doesn't run out, this one will be put there as well. So here's the title of the talk. What I'm going to do here, I've been asked to speak for an hour. I don't know if you know that, but I've been asked to speak for 1 hour. And what I want to do is basically give you a sense of, in a way, a kind of a personal sense of why I think science is a very important topic, and especially a kind of an important topic at a normative level. In other words, science says something about what the human condition is about and how we ought to be as people, and how that notion has sort of become transformed over the course of history. And the history I'm going to talk about is, for the most part, Western history, but then talk about how this has been changing in the last few years. Because I think one of the things, I think it was alluded to in the introduction, if I heard it correctly, is I'm associated with this field of science and technology studies, STS. And one of the things that this field has done over the last 25 or 30 years is to basically deconstruct the concept of science, right? In the sense that the whole idea of science as a sort of privileged, normatively privileged form of knowledge has come under quite a lot of scrutiny and criticism from many different quarters, actually, within the STS community. It's not just a sort of single critique, but it comes from many different angles. And so there is an open question today about exactly what is the status, the normative status of knowledge of science as a form of knowledge in society. And so I think it's very important to get a sense, in the beginning at least, of what it was that was supposed to have privileged science in the first place. Okay, and we really do need to look at the history, because a lot of it has to do with very distinctive features of the history of the West. Because I know we use the word knowledge and science in very general kinds of ways to cover all forms of knowledge, but I think when it comes to this idea of science as being a sort of premier form of knowledge, a very specific concept is implied. And I want to start out by presenting that and saying something about where that concept came from. I think the first thing to say about the concept of science as a form of knowledge is that science is somehow interested in knowledge that's deep. That is to say, it's not just interested in knowledge of the appearances, you know, of ordinary experience or something like that. There's some idea that there's some depth to reality. There's something that lies behind the appearances. Science is committed to that kind of notion, and I think the clearest way to see that is in terms of the concepts that science works with, and this is true especially in the physical sciences, but also to a large extent within the social sciences as well. The concepts of science are removed from everyday experience, right? There's a sense in which there's some sort of deeper kind of structure to reality beyond just the normal way in which we understand things. And this kind of depth, of course, is one of the reasons why you need to have training in science, right? You have to see the world in a certain way that's different from the ordinary way of seeing the world. Why is that? Well, because science claims to be getting at a kind of deeper reality. Now, it's not just that the reality is deep. It has other characteristics as well. And the characteristic that I think is very, very relevant in terms of the period we're in now, and in a way this is what characterizes kind of what we call the sort of modern worldview of science, right, is the idea that in some sense, ultimately, science is unified. Methodologically, ontologically, right, that there's a sense in which, at the end of the day, what science is going after is some sort of unified account of reality, where all the differences that we see at the level of experience and appearances, in a way, get resolved, theoretically, right? That there's some higher explanatory argument that can be made. Some sort of, you know, so you think about Newton's laws, for example. Newton's laws is probably the sort of best example of an attempt to unify phenomena that prior to Newton were seen as really quite different because they were experienced differently at the empirical level. So Newton, right, was trying to basically understand motions on the Earth, and and the way in which the bodies in the heavens moved, which historically, you know, to the naked eye look quite different. But nevertheless, Newton was able to talk about these things and understand these things under a common set of laws. Okay? So there's this quest for unity. And this quest for unity has probably been most consistently pursued mathematically. Okay? And in a sense, this is where quantification is quite an important feature of science. Because what quantification does is it provides, you might say, a common currency for talking about a lot of things that at a surface experiential level look rather different. But if you can stick numbers on them and you can put equations around them, then you get some way of comparing and organizing them in some kind of systematic fashion. And so this is why when one talks about the unity of science, mathematical and quantitative discussions are never far behind. Okay, that is a very, and so it's not by accident that Newton was primarily a mathematician. Okay, he was lecturing in mathematics at Cambridge during the period in which he wrote his famous works. Of course, Newton did experiments as well, and that is not a trivial point. The experimental side, of course, is very important to science. But in terms of science providing a privileged form of knowledge that is better than ordinary knowledge, then this quest for unification, right, where the depth ultimately resolves itself in a single picture of the world, has been very important. And if you look in the history of the modern period from Newton to the present day, okay, you have again and again these projects to unify knowledge. Okay, positivism has probably been the movement that's been most closely associated with it, but in fact, idealism is not much different, frankly, in that regard. This quest for unity. Now, why is there this quest for unity? Okay, why would... And this has a lot to do with some assumptions about the nature of reality. Right, because you might say, well, look, the world is so radically different. Things appear to the senses in such radically different ways. Why should we even be in the business of trying to unify radically different things by mathematics, which ends up abstracting away in a very serious fashion? Why should we do that? Why is that a worthwhile activity? Okay. And here we get to a very important point about the character of reality that science presupposes. And this is a very important feature, and it's where science, in fact, derives a lot of its influence from theology. Because the idea is that reality is intelligible, and what intelligible means is it is understandable. In other words, you are not wasting your time by studying it deeply. It will reveal its secrets to you. Why? Well, because the being that created reality has a mind kind of like yours. This is a very important point. This is where the theological moment comes in, and why there was this distinctive drive to science within the cultures that came from the Abrahamic religions. And what is characteristic of this, you know, what we call monotheism, is the idea that human beings are created in the image and likeness of God. That's a very distinctive theological doctrine. Okay? And this is where human privilege comes from. And this is meant to be a kind of deep doctrine, in the sense that God kind of created us as a mini-God. Right? And part of the ways in which we fulfill our potential, rising above the animals, let's say, is by understanding God's creation. So there's a kind of mission that human beings have to actually make sense of the universe. And there is a universe. There is a unity to be understood. Because you see, these notions aren't obvious on their face. Most cultures throughout the world, I would say including the Chinese culture, do not have these assumptions. There isn't this presupposition that there is this unified intelligibility to reality. Okay? I mean, this requires a very distinctive notion of why you would think the universe has this kind of rational coherence to it. Because on an everyday level, it doesn't present itself that way. There's, in fact, multiple experiences moving in many different directions. You see? So, this is a very important point. And remember, When we're talking about science, we're not talking about a hobby. We're not just talking about something people might want to do for fun. We're talking about something that entire societies, you know, end up treating as the gold standard for all other forms of knowledge. Right? So ordinary experience gets judged against science. Now, I would maintain that this is a very strongly theological residue. It's kind of like, you might say, the last moment of the whole theological influence on the what is otherwise a very secular Western tradition, is this idea that the whole idea of thinking about reality as unified and intelligible, and that doing science will get you to figure it out, that is like the salvation story in Christianity, basically. It's the same idea when it gets right down. In fact, historically, they're very closely connected to each other in the West. Okay? It's been very secularized now, no doubt about it. But again, you might say, why have this assumption in the first place? Now, I mention all this because we live in a period now where all of this is being very strongly challenged. Right? It's being very strongly challenged in the West, in the East, everywhere. Right? And when we talk about something like postmodernism. Okay? Postmodernism is the challenge to this picture, right? Where postmodernism says, right, we haven't yet become fully secularized because we still believe in this kind of Newton-style science. And as long as we still believe in that, we're still in the theological tradition. Because why would you believe that reality is unified? Why believe that, you know, pursuing science forever, especially for its own sake, will get you to some ultimate truth? Why would you believe that if you don't believe in a certain kind of God? So if you don't believe in that God, there's a big question for you. And of course, nowadays, you know, the people who hold on to this ideal the most in the scientific community are the physicists. Right? Because that's where this idea came from. That's where it has primarily flourished. In a way, it continues to flourish to a large extent. So that even physicists who are avowedly atheist, so you may know, of course, about Stephen Hawking. Right? Stephen Hawking claims to be an atheist. But his best-selling books, right, including A Brief History of Time, what's the point of the book, as he talks about it, to get into the mind of God? Now, you see, somebody like Newton literally was trying to do that. And maybe Einstein was still trying to do that, literally. Get into the mind of God. But what does that phrase mean if you don't believe in God? What is this mind we're talking about? Because, see, this is where Hawking is trying to justify the search for the grand unified theory of everything. Right, which is kind of the holy grail of science, where all the forces of nature will be unified under a very few set of physical laws. Now that's an idea that makes sense if you imagine there's a God who operates by a blueprint that is those laws, and that's how he created the world, and what we basically do when we do physics is to reverse engineer God's creation. If that's what we do when we do physics, then what Hawking is trying to do makes perfect sense. But if you don't believe there's a God to reverse engineer, why are we so concerned about having a grand unified theory of everything? In which case, why do we spend so much money in the Large Hadron Collider at CERN? Right, where we're trying to get to these fundamental particles that in a way can cast experimental light on these various theories of how everything hangs together in the universe. Why do we continue doing that if we don't any longer believe in the background theology? You see, the metaphors are still there. The mind of God is talked about a lot, especially in popularization. But if you don't believe in God, whose mind are you talking about? So the point here is that the significance of science, the value of science as a form of knowledge, has very much hung on this kind of idea. It's one of the things that makes it very clearly different from other forms of knowledge. Because other forms of knowledge are much more grounded in experience of various kinds. So for example, you may know, we've got this word in English and in other languages, expertise. Expertise is a word that really comes into play in the English language in the late 19th century. And it's basically adopted from the French. And what it literally means is experienced. experienced. Okay? And so the idea, the presupposition of the idea of expertise is you have this form of knowledge because you are experienced in a certain domain of reality. And the idea is the domain is limited, right? It's based on what you have had repeated sensory contact with, what your experience has been about. Okay, so you can be an expert in a certain area of research that you've been doing for 20 years, where you've worked in the lab, you've come up with results that you've published, and you're an expert in that. There are lots of ways of becoming an expert, but they all involve direct experience with reality, and it's limited to the part of reality with which you have had direct experience. This is quite different from the conception of science. Because the conception of science, in a way, goes beyond experience, transcends experience. It's aiming for a form of knowledge that abstracts away from the differences in expertises. Okay? So you can be expert in particular fields and particular disciplines, but science ultimately aims at what are the laws or the principles that unify all those expertises. And the question is, are there such laws? Is there such a unity being found? Are there such principles? And that's what's being challenged today by the postmodern condition. Because basically, postmodernists say, no, there really isn't science in this sense that I've been talking about. What there are multiple expertises. Right? And they all are relevant in certain domains, but not others. And there's a lot of conflict between them and all of this. And if you'd like to get philosophical about it, you know, those of you who've been at the conference on peer review that ended just now, Bob Frodeman likes to talk about regional ontologies. This is a very fancy kind of word for talking about what it is that experts have a grasp over. Every expert is a master of a regional ontology. See, a regional ontology means what are the particular objects in the world that you come into contact with when you're in that world. And for each world, you have a different set of objects. And there's no assumption that all these objects are going to be combined or resolved in some other higher level fashion. Okay? So the whole idea of regional ontology, which is a very popular idea now, both within philosophy and in science and technology studies, is connected to the notion of expertise and is very much against this kind of large sense of science that I've been talking about. And it's very characteristic of our time that we're in. And you see, one of the problems, you might say, that arises when you stick to a notion of regional ontology and expertise is that you're in a way so close, you're at the level of ordinary experience almost, that it becomes difficult to say what makes you so different from someone else. Because you don't have a higher form of knowledge, you just have a form of knowledge that comes about through repeated experience, which in a sense anyone in principle could have. Okay, so there's an issue here about what kind of authority would science be able to exercise if it called itself just an expertise. But of course, what we now say, right, is that science is really just a set of expertises. Right, so science is in a way, you might say, a kind of an aggregate. In grammar, we talk about aggregate terms, which basically just talk about things as a collection, without implying that there's some sort of whole that they form. Right, so you can talk about a collection of rocks. Right, well, in a sense, a collection of expertises is what science is. There's no underlying unifying logic. There's just this collection of things, right, that are expertises. So we're moving very much in that kind of direction. And I would say that from a historical and cultural standpoint, most cultures throughout most of history have had the viewpoint that we call postmodern. Okay? That would be one thing I would say. And that the whole modern idea, the idea that there's a unified notion of science of the kind that I was just describing, is actually very particular. It is very much part of the history of the West, with a very strong theological backdrop to it, which has gained prominence in the same way as the West has ascended. It's the same process, basically. It's happened the same way, often the same people doing it. Okay, and so as the political and economic forces of the world change, one should expect there would be some changes here as well, and I think we're beginning to see it. And I think in a way, part of what postmodernism reflects is a certain kind of self-doubt of this kind of modern Western project. Okay, and that one, in a sense, is trying to go to a back to a form of knowledge that is, in a way, comparable to forms of knowledge outside of the West. Okay, that's kind of how I see it. Now, depending on where you come in on this discussion, this either seems like a really good idea, this postmodern idea, or a really bad idea. Okay, and I've been one of the people who, in a sense, because generally speaking, it's welcomed, this move. This move is generally speaking welcomed, I would say, the postmodern move. And I think one of the ways you can see this is in terms of the way in which, I mean, if those of you who were at the conference, you saw Mark Frankel. Okay, Mark Frankel is a representative of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. That is basically the most important PR wing of the scientific community in America. Okay? And his attitude was very postmodern, it seemed to me, about what exactly is science's role, what kinds of impositions can it put on culture, right? How do other cultural values need to be respected? There are other forms of knowledge. If a community says they don't want a certain kind of scientific activity taking place, it's their right to say no. Science does not have the final say on everything. That's very postmodern, actually. And it's coming from the guy who is part of the PR division of the scientific establishment. That's very interesting, right? That would not have been the case 20, 30 years ago. But this is what people are saying. So the postmodern view of science is very strong and very much in place now. So the question is, what is lost from the modern standpoint? And I've actually written a lot about this. And I do think that to a large extent, it's very hard to see why people were so captivated by the kind of modern, unified, rational conception of science as they were without reminding people of some of the theology. Because it really does have to do with a certain very self-confident view of human beings that was involved. Okay? And now, one of the points about science that I haven't made yet, which is in a way quite relevant to the story, is the fact that science, classically speaking, is seen as universal knowledge. That is to say, it is potentially applicable to everyone, and in principle, everyone should be able to understand it. Okay, universality of the knowledge. This is one way in which science, classically speaking, was supposed to be different from expertise. Because if you look at what were the original forms of expertise in the ancient world and throughout most of culture, one would think about priests, right? Religious priests, you know, a privileged knowledge of God or something, or the sacred, which is supposed to be responsible for what makes the society works. And you have to basically trust the priest, just like you have to trust the expert. And in many ways, part of the rhetoric of the medical profession in the modern era was to appropriate a lot of the rhetoric of the priesthood. So you can trust your doctor, who in a way knows how your body works better than you do, just like the priest knows how your soul works better than you do. Even though you inhabit the body, he doesn't. Okay? And the point is, though, that science has always aspired to universality. So it covers all things for all people. Now, how do you see this? Well, I think, there are two points to be made. First of all, why believe it? Okay? Why believe that science is universal knowledge? And when I ask that question, my main stress is on the word universal. In other words, why should we believe there's any universal form of knowledge? Right? Science or whatever. Okay? And here, once again, I have to go back to the theological roots. Okay? Because part of the idea of all of us being seen as created in the image and likeness of God is a fundamental equality of people. Okay? Because they are privileged, human beings are all privileged vis-a-vis animals, but they are equal amongst themselves. Because they're all equally created in the image and likeness of God. And the universality that we're talking about here comes from that basic view, a fundamental equality of human beings. Okay? Now, I make this point because this is a metaphysical point. This is a point that's grounded in the idea that we all have souls that were endowed by God individually. So it's a very metaphysical, theological idea. It is not an idea that you would have ever come up with if you started with Darwin's theory. Right? Because for Darwin, what you see within a species is variation. Individual variation. Right? Around certain kinds of means, right? Norms. But nevertheless, there is no presumption that there is any sense, there's any kind of relevant sense of identity that one can point to that could be a basis for grounding norms. There's variation, and the variation reflects the environments in which the individuals live. That would be, and that's the view also that Aristotle had, right? Aristotle didn't have Darwin's theory of evolution, but the bottom line of Aristotle is not much different from Darwin on that point. There's no natural equality, there's a distribution of traits. Okay? So universalism, the universalism of science, presupposes a fundamental equality of people. Okay? Now, how has this idea been carried out in the history? Well, this is where I know everybody hates logical positivism. That's usually, you know, if you want to talk about bad philosophers, blah, blah. But now, the interesting thing about logical positivism is the fact that they took this universalist idea very seriously. Remember, their view is that nothing counts as knowledge proper unless it can be reduced to observations that in turn can be experimentally tested, right, and can be organized in terms of some transparent logical system where you can see all the steps of the reasoning. From a cognitive standpoint, that's very basic, right? And that's why we talk about the positivists as reductionists. Right? So they're taking all the complexity of the scientific jargon, right? All the big concepts the scientists have, right? By which they sort of establish their difference from everybody, and basically saying, if this has any cognitive meaning, it has to be reducible to the level at which someone who is not trained in the specialized language can understand it. So in other words, an ordinary person should be able to see the observation. An ordinary person should be able to follow the experiment, should be able to go through the logical reasoning. That is the sense of fundamental cognitive equality that is key to science. It's that idea, I think, that the positivists really picked up on and ran with. And that's one of the reasons why these guys, to a person, were, you know, democratic socialists. They weren't conservatives, they weren't elitists. They were democratic socialists. Okay? And so I do think that the universalism of science is a very political kind of thing when it gets right down to it. And it does impose certain obligations on the scientific community in terms of how it deals with the public. Right? So in other words, if science wants to present itself as knowledge that everyone in the public should be supporting, then it should be intelligible to everyone in the public who is supporting it. Now, this is a real challenge. And the logical positivists actually tried to come up with ways of dealing with this. And the positivist who was probably the most interested in this idea, in this project, was Otto Neurath. I don't know how much you study the logical positivists here, but Otto Neurath was this economist, sociologist, Marxist persuasion, who had all kinds of very ingenious ideas for making scientific data more presentable, more transparent, so that people could actually engage with the results of research. Much of it involved, by the way, pictures, visualizations, because people often can understand the visualizations better than understanding the words. Okay? So this was very much, this has been very much part of the scientific, that it's universal knowledge. And it's knowledge that everyone, in principle, can have access to and can contribute to. And historically in the West, moving into the sciences has in fact been a very important motivator of class mobility. Okay? Because if you think about it, the humanities historically have been very much tied to people who are very much rooted in sort of the cultural traditions, and usually these are the elites, people who went to the best primary and secondary schools, who know multiple languages, in which all the major writings of the West have been written in, and have been written in many different languages, right? It's people with those kinds of elite backgrounds who could actually, you know, really master the humanities sufficiently to make a difference. And so, in fact, until the 20th century, most of the contributors to the humanities were basically people from well-to-do backgrounds. It's relatively rare that you find people who come from poor backgrounds. They do exist, but relatively rare. But the natural sciences, because in a sense the sort of fundamentals of the natural science has to do with proving things experimentally in the open by making your arguments explicit from principles that you identify that other people can recognize, right, in a way has been much more of a democratizing form of knowledge as a matter of fact. Again, not completely, but if one is comparing the humanities and the natural sciences in particular, you would see a very striking contrast, it seems to me. And so that's been a very important part of the way of the universalism of the natural sciences. By the way, another aspect of this universalism, which also comes from the theology, has to do with a very distinctive feature of the Abrahamic religions. And here I mean particularly Christianity and Islam, both of them. And that's what we call proselytism. I don't know if you run across this word. This is the idea that everybody ought to believe what you believe. It's universal. It's a kind of proactive universalism, right? In other words, because if you think about it, if you do a study of comparative religions, okay, most religions are in fact the religions of a particular culture, of a particular place, and they're pretty much indistinguishable from the culture of the place. So in other words, they're very much grounded. They're very localized, in a sense. Even if the locality, you know, as in the case of China, is quite big, it is nevertheless very much grounded in a particular place and culture. Christianity and Islam are very different in this regard. They are not grounded in a place or a culture. Their mission is to go from their origins and to spread around the world. Right? And in a sense, because of this doctrine of universalism, everybody is eligible. Everybody should be open to this. This is the best thing that could happen to them. Right? Both cultures have been like this. And this is one of the reasons why there has been historically such a sharp conflict between the historically Christian cultures and the historically Muslim cultures. I mean, what Freud would call a narcissism of small differences. Right? Basically, there are two cultures that think very much the same way about things, right, but differ on the specifics. And that's what they're really fighting over. But both of them have this kind of universalism going on, which means you've got to spread the word. You've got to convert people. Now, I say this because science has this too. This is a characteristic of scientific knowledge, right? You are meant to feel deficient if you don't have it. And you know, again, going back to Mark Frankel's talk, right? Scientific literacy, right? Not enough people believe in science. They don't know enough science. We've got to give them more science. It's a national problem. It's a global problem. This is proselytism, right? This is saying they're lacking something in their lives that would make them more complete, more, you know, better citizens or something. Well, this is very similar to the arguments for spreading Christianity and Islam. And that people need to be educated, need to be taught the Bible or the Quran, right, or Newton's mechanics. They got to be taught this stuff. And I think the person who, at least in the UK, really exemplifies this mentality is Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins, if you know about Richard Dawkins, he's the ultimate proselytizer for science. I don't know if you know, but late last year, Dawkins published a book. If you haven't seen it yet, so this is Richard Dawkins, and the book's entitled The Magic of Reality. It's a children's book. Get them while they're young. Okay? And so this is the idea, right, that Richard Dawkins, is so concerned that young children are not learning the scientific worldview at an early enough age, that they're learning all of these various creation myths from all sorts of cultures, not just Christianity, but everywhere. Everywhere is a fair target for him. That they need something at their level to convert them to science early on. Because if they're not converted to science, by the time they enter the school system is not good enough to pull it off. The school system will not give them a scientific mentality. So you need the parents to buy this book and to teach the kids when they're 7 or 8 years old. Okay, this is the idea. And you get this idea, you know, souls being saved. Right? This is a saving... And again, the relationship is not accidental. This is very much part of what the whole idea of science has been about. It's this universal form of knowledge with this kind of theological backdrop, you know, which has its secular offspring. And that's why science has this kind of character that it does. And I think it's too easy to sort of dismiss somebody like Richard Dawkins, you know, as just a, you know, a crazy guy or something. Because in fact, I think he very much exactly has the kind of attitude that has enabled science to be as important as it has been in our culture. It has taken a lot of guys like him pushing this stuff down people's throats for it to have the kind of normative significance that it does. Because again, at the end of the day, the kind of knowledge that science is giving you is very removed from your everyday experience. So you're being told, for example, that, you know, life's been around for several billion years. The way things are now came about through glorified accident, right? I mean, it's not obvious. This is not obvious to the untrained mind. Okay? People need to be taught this idea. Okay? And so this is also very much part of what I'm talking about here. And then there's one more feature. One more feature of the modern notion of science, which I think actually has a lot of important policy implications. And that's the idea science is an intergenerational project. You do not solve the problems of science in one day or even in your own lifetime. That's a very important part of science. It is grossly underestimated, but it is really distinctive, it seems to me, as a science as a form of knowledge. Nobody ever expects that the problems of science will be solved in the lifetime of a given scientist. Right? I mean, we always quote Newton, right? If I have seen as far as I have, it is because I have stood in the shoulders of giants. Right? What does that imply? Right? That implies there's this very long-term quest with lots of people building on each other's work, moving toward some clearer and clearer notion of the truth. That's the kind of idea. Okay? Now that idea is very much a kind of, it's based on biblical salvation story, okay? Now what am I talking about here from a theological standpoint? Well, the thing about human beings, if you buy into the Judeo-Christian tradition, is human beings actually have the essence of God within them, but they are fallen creatures. They start with lots of disadvantages because of original sin. You've heard about original sin, I'm sure. Adam and all that. Okay? So human beings are very imperfect, very fallible. But they have the potential to becoming godlike again. Okay? And what that means is they have to somehow get rid of all of this fallibility. They have to somehow get rid of all of this stuff that holds them back. And of course, in the theological tradition, this is something that you might do through prayer or good works or, you know, adopting a kind of ascetic discipline if you're a monk, right? That's the kind of thing you would do from a theological standpoint. But from a scientific standpoint, what you do is you test your hypotheses and you get rid of the error, you know, once you discover it, and then you put forward better hypotheses that in turn can be tested. And of course, if you know about Karl Popper, that's where his theory of science is coming from, right? This is Karl Popper's theory of science. It is a theory of science that, what you know, of course, sociologists always say, no scientists actually follow it, blah, blah, blah. Nevertheless, practicing scientists do believe it. And that's the interesting point. You know, Popper's view is a view they relate to. Okay? And this is very much a kind of secular version of purging sin. Removing error is like purging sin, and this is kind of how science goes. And this is why what you do when you do science is you test hypotheses. You don't just confirm what you already believe. You just don't collect data for its own sake to confirm your prejudices. You test things. You always assume that whatever you already believe might be radically wrong. Right? So in other words, you assume error on your own part, and then the question of science is to discover where the error is. And that's why you do experiments and research over and over and over again to no end. You just keep on doing it. Nothing is ever perfect. Nothing is ever finished. Okay? This is very much like this kind of eternal purging of sin. Because again, what I'm pointing out to you is this is a very distinctive way of thinking about knowledge. Because most forms of knowledge build on already agreed experience and basically confirms that experience. Right? So you end up, you know, there's a body of knowledge people have had traditionally. They pass it on to the next generation, and then people kind of build on it, but very much along similar lines. And so it becomes difficult ever to talk about progress in traditional knowledge. You just talk about it being transmitted, right, and maintained. But you don't talk about progress, because progress implies you're leaving part of it behind. You're saying some of it was wrong, some of it was bad, and now you're in a better state. Okay? Science is very closely connected with that kind of mentality. Again, a distinctive attitude toward knowledge. And it comes from this kind of salvation idea. Okay, and this is why, by the way, in the traditional theological salvation stories, what you get at the end is the city of God, right? You get some magic moment where somehow, either in heaven or in earth, everything is perfect. You got kind of this perfect utopia, this organization. Now, of course, science is full of those kinds of stories, right? And science fiction, as a genre, in a way, is predicated on that kind of mentality. This kind of utopian mentality. Remember, Utopia is the name of a book that was originally written by Thomas More, who's a saint in the Catholic Church and was the chancellor to Henry VIII, and migrated into the scientific arena, this idea of utopia. And it is basically what you find at the end of this whole quest toward salvation. Okay? Again, this is very distinctly associated with science. And to give you a sense of a contrast, if you look at the Greeks, because you know, very often in the West, you have people saying that the Greeks originated science. Okay? The Greeks had very little of what I'm talking about here. They had the notion of depth. They did have the notion there's a deeper notion of reality. They did have that. But almost everything else they didn't have. Plato did have the unified notion of reality. He certainly had that. But what the Greeks did not have that's really important is this idea that science is something that continues generation after generation and makes progress by leaving behind error and building on truth. That the Greeks did not have. The Greeks believed what they called science was basically an activity, as it were, that people who had leisure, who didn't have to do any work for a living, could do kind of in the way one would do physical fitness. You know, science was like athletics for the mind. That was the right? I mean, and so, you know, and it was something that was to be, as it were, the value of it came from the experience that the person had from doing it. Just like with physical fitness, right? The beneficiary is the body that is stronger and more agile and so forth. The same thing with doing science, right? You become more acute, you can see things more deeply, right? You're not so confused. It's a really personal discipline that you are undergoing when you do science in the Greek world. There isn't this sense of a sort of long-term intergenerational mission. Some of you may know Max Weber. Max Weber, toward the end of his life, gave this very famous address at the University of Munich to graduate students called Science as a Vocation. And if you look at the image of the scientist in that lecture and compare it to what Plato and Aristotle might have been going on about science, it is radically different. Because basically, Weber is telling you that you are basically just one piece of a very big puzzle, and your own significance will disappear before you know it. Okay? And that the reason and the way you get meaning from doing this very insignificant piece of work that is your science is because you imagine this larger picture, this longer trajectory, this great path that you are on, that all these other people have been on, and that other people in the future will be on. It is a great mission to find the truth. And it's the ennobling aspect of that that gives meaning to the activity you're doing. It isn't that it makes you feel good or makes you brilliant or makes you more mentally agile or anything like that. No, it's this idea that you're contributing to this long-term project. Okay? Because in fact, to be a good scientist, according to Weber, right, is to become, especially in the modern era, a specialist. And a specialist narrowly focused on very particular pieces of work. Not someone with a great vision. But you have to know that there is a great vision, and you're contributing a little bit to it. But you yourself never know what exactly is your contribution at the end. So from an existential standpoint, you're always in a position of doubt. But what keeps your belief going is this larger project. Now, this is a kind of Christian existentialism, secularized. That's really what we're talking about here with Max Weber. A kind of Christian existentialism secularized as a justification for doing science. Okay? And this is in 1918. And that is so different from what the Greeks were about. I mean, it light years away. The Greeks would look at somebody like Max Weber and laugh. And they'd say, "You poor fool, you're subject to delusions. What is this great path? What is this great journey? What is this great future? You got to live in the moment, man. Right? You've got to get the knowledge that makes you live a good life." And this is what Frodeman is often about. You know, if you saw Bob Frodeman, that's what his shtick is, right? You need knowledge to live a good life. And not surprisingly then, something like science, in that classical modern sense, isn't really that. Right? It's a kind of secular continuation of the Salvation Project. Where, as it were, the value of it is redeemed in the indefinite future. Right? Science is ultimately about the value lying in the future. And that's why you should take the risks, that's why you should invest the money, that's why there is all this emphasis in science, blue skies research, basic research. This is a very distinctively scientific way of thinking about knowledge again. Because in a sense, you have to commit yourself to this without anticipating who the beneficiaries are, when they're going to happen, will there be other things going on? You see, this is where the theology, I think, helps to explain a lot of this. This kind of unconditional commitment. And in the end, you know, in the modern period, what justified all this was the fact that it reflected upon us as superior beings. Right? Because science has this kind of value because it's where humanity will distinguish itself from the animals. It is where we will really strike out and be radically different. Because animals, and this is of course true as we learn from biology, they understand perfectly well the environments in which they live. And that is kind of the scope of their epistemology, you might say. It is the worlds in which they live. And they know that very well. They are adaptive. Their knowledge is purely adaptive. But we, human beings, aspire to know everything, regardless of its adaptive value. Regardless of whether it helps us continue to live as biological creatures. We aspire to all knowledge. And as you know, aspiring to all knowledge is bloody dangerous for our biological condition. This is how we got nuclear energy. Okay? This comes from this kind of unconditional quest for knowledge. You can actually jeopardize the biological character of our existence. And so just as much as science has enhanced us as beings, it has also put us in increasing risk, simultaneously, at the same time. And the modern project is about accepting that. It is basically saying, yeah, that is what human beings are. We are the creatures who take those kinds of risks and win. Because if we were stupid creatures, we would get obliterated eventually after taking all of these radical risks. But we're still here, and we're going to take more risks in the future. Okay? Now, the reason why I put it this way, I'm describing the matter this way, is because we're now in a period where I think there's a kind of fundamental choice in worldviews that come out of science. Just checking on the time here. Okay, so I have maybe 10, 15 minutes more? Okay. I don't know how widely circulated it was, but I sent an article to you, to Chin, which is a recent piece I have. It's a newspaper article. It's not very long. And it's on a book I'm currently writing. And it makes this distinction between the precautionary and the proactionary principles. Okay? And what I argue in this article, which is available in Chinese, I mean, it's part of, this article appears as part of the series of columns that are published by Project Syndicate. You can find it on the web. Okay, so Project Syndicate is this, it's an organization that that provides newspaper columns written by various public intellectuals, you know, people like Fukuyama, Peter Singer, Jeffrey Sachs, Joseph Stiglitz, these kinds of guys, and puts them in newspapers around the world in multiple languages. And so if you go to the website where this article is, you'll see it in China, you'll see it in eight languages already. And it's about, I'm talking about there, the way in which ideological differences will be defined in the future in terms of attitudes towards science. Okay? And from the standpoint of the discussion that I've been having here with you so far, the proactionary perspective, the second one of those two, is the one that is in a way most like the classical modern perspective, that basically thinks that in a sense, the way we should be thinking about our relationship to the world is as creatures who are trying to distinguish ourselves more and more, to take more control of the world, and to, as it were, create more and more distance from our animal origins. Okay? So in other words, it is a kind of celebration of risk-taking. Right? And saying that basically, so for example, this is a kind of approach that celebrates scientific innovation, technological innovation, and basically saying, yes, you don't always know all of the consequences of technological innovation, but if you actually design things in a certain way, you should be able to intelligently take the risks. Okay, and so the whole idea here is the proactionary principle says that science teaches us that we are getting better and better at intelligent risk-taking, and that we should continue to take more risks. Okay, and this perspective has lots of implications, not just in terms of how we fund research projects, but also in terms of how we think about ourselves as beings. Because this term proactionary is one that was only coined in 2004. So it's a very new term. And it was basically coined by the transhumanist movement. And I don't know how much you know about these guys, but these are people who are very much into the idea that we are now in a position where we can enhance the human condition. We can genetically modify ourselves, right? We can, in all kinds of ways, we can kind of move into humanity 2.0. And in fact, a long-term projection would be that maybe we can even upload our consciousness into a sort of more durable android form that will allow us to do everything that we regard as valuable as being a human being forever. Okay? And that far end, we get guys like Ray Kurzweil, okay, and the singularity. You may have heard about this. And you see, so the point here is the proactionary principle isn't simply about risk-taking with regard to the environment or with regard to scientific hypotheses, but it is also about risk-taking about the kinds of beings we are, how we constitute ourselves as beings, and the degree of experimentation that we want to have on our own bodies, and the kinds of relationships we have with ourselves and with other beings. Okay? So, for example, I recently published a book called Humanity 2.0, which has a little bit of this in it. And the book was launched at the Royal Society for the Arts. And there's a YouTube clip about it, if you can find it. And one of the things that I did was I issued a survey asking people, you know, getting people's views that if it were possible, because you know we have a National Health Service in Britain, and in the next few years it's probably going to be quite structurally reorganized, and there's going to be an issue about who is eligible to be covered under it. And this is a very interesting test for these kinds of ideas. Because so far, in the history of the welfare state, it's fair to say, the presupposition has always been that other human beings ought to be covered. They should be whoever's covered, it should be human beings in a kind of national health service. But if you gave people a free vote, and you gave them the option of including, on the one hand, animals, and on the other hand, perhaps certain kinds of machines, okay, as being the sorts of things whose health and maintenance and well-being one should provide, you know, publicly subsidized support for, I bet that the final list would not be 100% human. Okay? That they would include quite a few animals and probably quite a few androids and other non-animal beings. And this has a lot to do with how human defines itself. And the proactionary principle basically says that's the next stage in human development, is actually to redefine what our bounds of affiliation are, and they don't necessarily have to be primarily with beings of our own biological origin. That biology doesn't have to define the terms of our politics in that sense. That's a very radical idea, I understand. But it seems to me that, in a sense, science, by calling us to think more and more deeply about the kinds of beings that we are, actually pushes us more in that direction. And then the other perspective, and I will just end by putting the perspectives up there, the precautionary one. You may have run across the precautionary principle in environmental politics. It's a much older principle. It basically goes back to the early 19th century. It originated in Germany. It was originally connected with forestry, right? With forestry, basically leave as much, you know, with all of the building that's going on during the early 19th century as part of the Industrial Revolution, right? Leave as much of a forest as you found, right? So in other words, you keep on making sure the trees are planted, that you have a kind of, so that the next generation has the same amount of forest to work with as you have. That's been the precautionary principle, to kind of maintain that. So it's a kind of steady state view of the world. And along with the precautionary principle comes the appeal to science as showing us the uncertainty of our knowledge. Okay? In other words, we shouldn't take too many risks. We should be concerned about whether the consequences in the future will end up making the situation for our descendants worse than we have now. That's what the precautionary principle is about concern about future generations, and to use science as a vehicle for minimizing risk. Okay, and very not surprisingly, very much the environmental movement has very much supported this. Now, one of the assumptions of this principle is the idea that one of the things that science teaches us is not only that there's a lot of uncertainty in our knowledge, because our knowledge is often shown to be wrong, nobody denies that, but also that in a sense, science also teaches us something about ourselves in that, and again, Darwin is very important here, we are ultimately biological creatures. We are part of the earth, right? That there's a sense in which if we are not concerned about the state of the earth and we're not concerned about other species, we will obliterate ourselves, because at the end, human beings are nothing but animals that live in this earth. Okay? And all the talk about sending us up into space colonies and turning us into computers is just fantasy. And that we have to and that the science tells us we're not going to realize those dreams, and that we are part of this biosphere, and that that's what science tells us, and that's what should keep us grounded, and is what should cause us to limit technological innovation to the stuff that does not have high risk. Okay? Now, it seems to me that these are the two worldviews that we are presented with in the 21st century, both of which come from science. The proactionary perspective, in a way, still tries to carry forward that classical modern view Whereas the precautionary principle says, what the history of science shows us is that we need to be much more cautious. We need to take much fewer risks. We need to realize that we are not gods in the making, but that we are just higher animals. And I think that this is, in a way, going to become a very important ideological conflict, and it's going to manifest itself in many different ways over the course of this century, and both sides rely on certain image of science. And I think, you know, as those of you who are going to be spending most of your life in this century, I think this is going to be a very, in a way, very exciting, but also very scary kind of challenge to negotiate. And with that, I think I'll stop here, because I think I've been speaking for about an hour, and I'd like to open it up for questions. Thank you so much for your patience.